From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, one Wisconsin family's experience with medical error became a beacon of hope and a call for reform, but it wasn't easy getting there.
We all make mistakes. You know, we're all humans, including doctors. Doctors are heroes, but things happen. It's not always negligence either. It's, you know, just sometimes things happen. The question is, when their mistakes are made, what are you going to do?
Then we'll hear about five things to do around town this month from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. And we'll hear some chamber music performed by the Prometheus Trio, recorded on site at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. Medical error is the third leading cause of death in America. Miscommunication between medical practitioners themselves and between them and their patients can lead to life-changing outcomes for those patients and their families. Stephen Burrow's experience is a testament to the pain, expenses, time, and emotional strife that's caused by medical error. In 2009, Burrow's mother, Judy, fell and went in for a routine partial hip replacement at the Aurora West Alice Medical Center. During the following months of recovery, she fell again. Then after 8 days in the hospital and a second hip surgery where she lost a significant amount of blood, Judy fell into a coma that resulted in permanent brain damage. Burrows is a comedian and filmmaker by trade, but he was thrown headfirst into becoming an advocate for his mother. With advice from friends and lawyers, the Burrows family decided to sue Aurora for medical malpractice. Burrows filmed his mother and her pain levels to keep records for the legal trial to come. That initial filming turned into material for his HBO documentary, Bleed Out. The film made its Wisconsin premiere at the Milwaukee Film Festival this past fall and has been screened all over since then, most recently in Capitol Hill for members of the U.S. Congress and their staffs. We're sad to report that Judy died on January 30th, so it's in her honor that we revisit our conversation with Steve Burrows that aired before Bleed Out's Wisconsin premiere. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski then, and he began by explaining why he decided to turn his mother's story into a documentary.
Well, you know, this has been a 10-year process for us. When I started to film in the early days, I was actually told by our medical malpractice attorneys within the first few days that I needed to film her pain and suffering. I needed to make a record of that because no one else was going to do it. And that was, through this whole process, easily one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do in my life is like stick a camera in my mom's face, especially back when we didn't even know if she was going to survive or pull through or coming out of that coma. So I was basically just documenting everything for the record because we had no idea where this thing was going. And then as I got deeper into this medical industrial complex siege, and I started to find out how difficult it was to get accountability and transparency, and how it was hard to even find an attorney to even take your case. And even the best cases lose 90% of the time. A friend of mine thought that maybe, you know, I should start thinking a little bit bigger and maybe not just make it just about my – I had basically three things. Take care of my mother, pursue justice the only way we could was in the court system, and then the backup plan, the plan C, was maybe make a documentary at some point. We were definitely 3 or 4 years into the litigation when I started to see how unbelievably difficult it was going to be, and I started to find out that medical error was the third leading cause of death in America and all these other things that you see in the film that I didn't know anything about, and I thought maybe – we might want to open this up a little bit because this personal story seems to be a universal one.
It wasn't until about 6 years after the initial events that the trial actually happened. So in the meantime, you are dealing with your mother's care, insurance companies, medical doctors, back and forth between Aurora, all of these things that people sometimes get thrown into. But I feel like a lot of times, unless it's an acute case such as yours and your mother's, but a lot of people will get those letters in the mail, the things from insurance, and they'll just want to get it paid and over with and toss it aside and move on. So what have you learned from taking a deep dive, and what would you encourage people to do to look a little more closely when it comes to looking at their own medical care? Because I feel like a lot of stuff just slips under the radar.
Right. Well, that used to be me. I didn't know anything about any of this. I didn't know anything about advocating for a person, you know, in the healthcare system. This was kind of, you know, my mom had made me power of attorney if anything ever happened. And we all, when we do those papers, when we get the papers together, you know, we go, oh, it just nobody wants to talk about it because who wants to deal with that? But my mom actually did her papers just about 2 years prior to this. And we never thought we'd ever have to become, like, I'd have to become activated power of attorney. And then it hits you. Like, so what are you going to do with the one thing I would tell most people at this point is that, you know, we're all going to get sick. We're all going to have family members are going to get sick. And we're all going to end up in the hospital at some point where our loved ones are. And what I learned is you need an advocate. You need someone who is your wingman, wingwoman, sidekick. Because when you're sick, you're not thinking straight. And you're scared and you're frightened. And you need someone like I literally write on my – I have a little list here. I always have my questions. And you will get better care regardless of the institution. You're going to get better care if you have someone who is asking the basic questions, and there are no stupid questions. You know, this is your life. And occasionally you're going to irk a very busy doctor or nurse because they're probably overwhelmed as well. But it doesn't matter, you know, because it's going to force them to think about what they're doing, how they're doing it. The other thing I learn now that I wish I would have known this. I could have avoided this whole thing is if I would have gotten a second opinion, like right away for my mom's hip surgery, the first hip surgery. If I just would have gone to just get a nice, clean, and what I've learned is that great doctors and nurses and hospitals, the reason I didn't do it is I didn't want to offend the doctor. I didn't want to make him mad or think I didn't trust him because we trust these caregivers, doctors, and hospitals blindly. I didn't do it. But I look back now and I go, that second opinion, there would have never been – we would have avoided this whole thing. And I would also say that I've learned that you actually – you know, it's tough to want to deal with this stuff. No one wants to, but I'm telling you, your life depends on it. And you got to start shopping. You know, we all shop for houses and cars and clothes, but we're not shopping for, you know, if you need your tonsils out, if you need to have appendix surgery, or I'm at, you know, any, like some type of, even a doctor's appointment, you're like what doctors, what institutions are specialized in what's going on with you? I think that shopping, it's your life. And 10 years ago, I would have just, whatever.
Yeah. I'll get to it when it reaches a point where
exactly.
I can't stand it.
You
can't
wait.
Yeah.
Don't wait.
Mm-hmm. Our state legislature has made it more difficult for patients to fight against hospital negligence. So what is Wisconsin's place in this? And is it unique or is it just one example of a nationwide trend?
It's my understanding that the national trend is not good with this, patient safety. Every state has these organizations, and now we've been meeting people especially the last 3 or 4 months, who are fighting in every one of their states for patient safety and patient rights. And like, can't we all, I mean, isn't this, shouldn't we all be on the patient rights? Isn't that something we can all agree on? And there are laws in each state where that are set up that limit patients' rights. Wisconsin is one of the worst, without any question. One of the harshest, even some of these laws like the doctor privilege law or the I'm sorry law or the single person law. Those are, even for these hardened pros who have been fighting for patients all these years, those laws shock the old pros. So it's bad here, real bad.
Another aspect to medical care that we all have to deal with is insurance companies. This film also shows just the widespread aspect of that medicine is corporate. It is a business, which in turn makes care impersonal. So do you think we're ultimately living with an inherently broken system if it's based off of business and policies and not about doctor-patient relationships at its core?
Right. Absolutely. In my experience, one should not how do I say this? The size of your wallet should not determine the quality of the healthcare that you get. And I know that I've learned through the vast majority of hospitals and doctors and nurses that we've met through this process is they all want to do the right thing. You know, they want to spend more time with the patient, especially the doctors. They'll, you know, like an office visit. And a lot of these doctors only can spend 10 to 15 minutes with a patient. And what they want is they want to be able to spend as much time with the patient as they need. And what we found in interviewing like the Mayo Clinic, we went to the Mayo Clinic in the film, and their whole thing is patient safety. The patient is first, not the money. Regardless of their ability to pay, you come into the Mayo Clinic and facilities like that, they look at you and it's all about what can we do for this patient? It's not about how many hip surgeries can we crank out a day. It's what does that one particular person need that day? And it works, but there's this money incentive and, you know, the insurance companies, they win no matter what happens. Whether they pay or not, they're still making money, regardless of the outcome of any patient situation. It's like, who's going to, you know, I keep asking in our film, like, who is in charge of my mom's care? Which I still don't know.
10 years later.
But who's in charge of healthcare? Like, somebody tell me.
Overall, yeah.
Right. I've been asking some of the brightest minds in patient safety, like, who's in charge of healthcare? And they're like, yeah, good question. That should frighten people. Scares me.
One thing that gave me pause was the whole aspect of telemedicine. So when your mother was moved to an ICU after her second hip surgery, there was a camera essentially watching over her in the corner that was linked to a remote care facility. You know, someone looking through monitors to check on patients versus a physical doctor right there with her post-surgery. And this is the focal point of what caused a lot of declining problems and long-term consequences. I wasn't even aware of telemedicine until this. So is this something that's very widespread, or was it just something that's being launched at several hospitals, or is it something that, again, is part of a system that's too big to fix or fail that is just a reality patients have to live with?
The telemedicine industry, especially this eICU thing, electronic ICU, is spreading like wildfire across the country. And I didn't know anything about it. And I'm glad you asked that question, because I was in the hospital with my mother after she was found in a coma. I actually found her in a coma. I was the person who noticed that something was wrong. She'd been there for 2 days in the ICU. And we found out about it by accident. Nobody at that facility told us anything about this. We wanted to meet with the doctor who was in charge of my mom's care in the ICU that night. And they said there wasn't a doctor there, that there was a camera doctor out by the airport. And that's all we knew. And then we started to investigate. We went through litigation. We found out, at least in our case here in Wisconsin, that this electronic ICU camera, in my mom's case, replaces the bedside doctor in the intensive care unit. Now, there's great reasons to use telemedicine, but it does not replace the bedside doctor. And nobody knows about this. We didn't. And then we found out during our litigation, our trial, that this place, it's out by the airport on the corner of Grange and Howell. And that one facility, we found that there's one doctor every 8 hours watching 15 intensive care units, and they only have, like, I guess, 4 or 5 monitors. And in our case, they told me the camera was never on with my mother. So I'm like, well, what's the I don't understand the point of this. And nobody knows about this. There was one doctor, our surgeon in our case, he claimed he never knew about it. And he was the surgeon. So if the surgeon didn't know, and if I didn't know, and you don't know 10 years later, I don't know what to tell you. That's one of the big reasons why we made this film, was when we found out about this electronic ICU, because I can tell you that, you know, critical care doctors across the country do not like this. You cannot.
Not in the you cannot, most critical time
yes,
of follow-up.
Yes, yeah, exactly. In intensive care, you cannot assess and manage a critical care patient through a camera that's not on.
There's a lot of questions about accountability, transparency. Now that we're 10 years down the road, I'm curious, have you heard anything from Aurora with this documentary?
Well, I have some breaking news for you. You're the first person to actually to know this because we never heard anything from Aurora until about a month and a half after the film came out, which was earlier this year. And I got a letter from the CEO of Aurora, and it was a handwritten letter sent privately. It was not sent, you know, certified or anything like that. And it was not made public. He didn't, I don't know why they didn't share it with everyone. But it was kind of an apology, not a full-throated apology. They're sorry that, you know, this happened to our family and the American healthcare system. You know, it was a nice letter. You know, they sent thoughts and prayers at the end, and there was no offer of any transparency or accountability. It was just like kind of acknowledging the story, acknowledging the film, and. You know, it was nice. So I wrote right back, and I sent it back to a letter back to the CEO to see if we could. I thanked him for the letter and see if we could meet to, you know, talk about things. I thought it was the beginning of a dialogue, and we have not heard back. And that's been 6 months.
Are you hopeful that it'll also be a call to action for systems like Aurora, for people studying medicine, for people already employed in medicine?
Yes. One of the best things that's happened through this disaster has been, you know, when the film came out, we were so fortunate to get the response was just really very encouraging. But then the public got hold of it. You know, HBO and their tentacles of, you know, millions of people then saw this movie. And then we started winning a couple pretty important awards. We won the Los Angeles Press Club for Best Documentary. And then the non-for-profit organizations, healthcare organizations, started getting a hold of this thing. The Leapfrog Group, the Patient Safety Movement, the Global Neurosciences Institute. These are like incredible organizations who have been doing this for years, who never had, you know, they have the story, they have the stats, they have the white papers, they have the research, but they've never seen, you know, it's different when you can feel it. I could have told you our story, but when we show it, when you see it, it's different. It's more powerful and it's more urgent. And that's what they're telling me. And then the next step is now universities and medical schools and nursing schools are making this a part of their curriculum to teach their medical students and residents and nursing students, because it's a 10-year kind of epic journey and this really happened in America and we all make mistakes. You know, we're all humans, including doctors. Doctors are heroes, but things happen. It's not always negligence either. It's, you know, just sometimes things happen. The question is, when the mistakes are made, what are you going to do? And the best thing that's happened is the film has turned into a call to action. That was not the intention. I just wanted to tell my mom's story. But now it's no longer our movie. It's the patients out there and their families and the fact that the medical community is embracing this film and using it as a teaching tool is now my mom's legacy. That's her legacy, that all of her, everything she went through, you know, I'm haunted by her pain and suffering to this day. People ask me if this has been a cathartic experience or it's been a healing experience for me somehow. I found peace. No, but I can tell you that my mom's story is helping people get better care. And, you know, I'm really grateful for that.
Along those lines, you know, on one hand, you come at this from a filmmaker and having done this for your career before the events with your mom happened. But it's also so emotionally entangling. You know, even before you decided to start making the documentary, you are spending time flying back and forth from LA to Milwaukee, dealing with insurance companies, dealing with hospitals, dealing with care, dealing with worrying about money, about your mom's money that had to go towards this. And now that you're in this stage and it's after this film is done and reaching audiences, how have you tried to continue to take care of yourself on a base level? Because it is hard when you do get wrapped up, deep dive into an acute case that many people, you know, would fathom to try and even begin to understand. So how have you tried to, I mean, it's not really possible to center yourself per se, but to shift your motivations throughout, to feed yourself and to try and keep it going.
Well, I can't lie. It's been tough at times. I think one advantage, I have a few advantages that a lot of these families that we've heard from, you know, over 5,000 other strangers and their families and their stories. And, you know, a lot of people can never do this. 10 years ago, we didn't know how long this was going to go. We didn't know if my mom was going to survive. We didn't know if she was going to be a long-term patient or a short-term patient. We didn't know how damaged she was going to be. So we kind of took it one day at a time, one week at a time. Next thing you know, it's months. Next thing you know, it's years. And it was always take care of mom first, get her day in court, and then maybe we'll do plan C. And then, as you saw, plan C became plan B. And plan A is still take care of mom. But if I wasn't in show business, if I had like a 9-to-5, I could have never done any of this. If I didn't have a wife who was 100% supportive of this, because you keep saying deep dive, it's like, yeah. I mean, I kind of, I would say to my wife every once in a while, am I like kind of like Ted Kaczynski now? Am I out in the woods in a cabin going crazy? This thing has obsessed me. There's no doubt about it. And I'm only coming out of, I would say the one really good thing about the film is because the film is now done. You know, our lawsuit is done. Our film is done. So there is like the dust has settled and I do see light, and mostly from these medical institutions who are using the film, I see real hope. And that's helping heal me a little bit. But without my wife, without my family and friends, and without my aunt, who really was a big believer in this, couldn't have done it. So, but I don't know. I mean, that's a really good question. No one's ever asked me that before. I'm not sure. I just keep going. I don't look back. Maybe I do look back. I'm looking back and in the present and in the future. I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, continue whatever you're doing, because this film is very impactful. And I know its reach will go far beyond the screening here at the festival as well. And Steve Burrows, I want to thank you for your work, for the work you continue to do.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here. It's a real privilege. Thank you.
Wisconsin native Steve Burrows is a writer, actor, and director. His latest documentary is called Bleed Out. His mother, Judy Burrows, passed away last week, 10 years after medical error altered her life. For more information about the film, please go to WUWM.com. Coming up after a break, 5 things to do in Milwaukee this month. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. February brings a lot of things to Milwaukee. It's the start of Black History Month, of course, and then there's Valentine's Day, Mardi Gras, or Pachki Day. And then there's even President's Day, as mattress store commercials are quick to remind us. And in honor of at least some of these holidays, this month's 5 Things to Do in Milwaukee has us celebrating in some unique ways. Anna Martinez-Ortiz is a community engagement reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. That service joins us each month to talk about community events that are happening in Milwaukee's Central City neighborhoods. Martinez-Ortiz joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio.
February is a lot of different things, of course, in the city of Milwaukee. All of your events, to some extent, pay homage to the various holidays and celebrations that we have in February. And we start with actually something that starts today, MPS's Black Lives Matter Week of Action. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Right. So I think we all know that the Black Lives Matter movement began a few years ago. And so I think this is MPS's way of making really a conscious effort to celebrate that movement and to keep it going. So they're going to have events going all next week, and they're free and open to the public, though they do ask that people register just so they can kind of determine how much space is available. Like, there's a screening of Push Out, the Criminalization of Black Girls in School. So if you really want to see that, registering for that event would kind of guarantee you a seat, more so some of the other events you might just be able to show up. There's also going to be Rufus King Middle School is hosting an open mic night and a poetry night. So, I mean, something like that, you might just be able to show up and hopefully get a seat. But again, it really just depends. It's going to be a lot of discussions and conversations about, you know, what Black Lives Matter means and how it plays out in Milwaukee.
So what kinds of events will there be?
I know there's going to be a conversation, an intergenerational conversation, you know, older folks and younger folks kind of getting together and discussing their lives and, you know, what the movement means for them and what it's going to mean going forward. But I think it's mostly about having that conversation and opening the floor to all of Milwaukee to come and participate.
Okay. So the next event, it's, again, kind of a month-long series of events from Black Lens Milwaukee. Can you tell us about some of those?
Yeah. So Black Lens Milwaukee is a part of the Milwaukee Film Festival. It's kind of like a subgroup within the program, but it specifically focuses on Black filmmakers and films that are starring Black protagonists. This month, actually, it's pretty cool because they're doing a focus on Black female filmmakers throughout the country. So they're going to do one event is called Black Women Behind the Lens, and they're going to have some special guests, and they're also going to be screening some of their short films that these women have made. And then there's another one that's both sides of the lens. So it's going to be looking at films by Black women that are also starring Black women. It's a great experience and very cool. I think short films can be a lot of fun because, you know, they're only 5 to 20 minutes long, and so you don't know what's going to happen, but it's usually a great story. And they're also going to be screening Love and Basketball, which is a classic film. And again, a lot of these events you have to register for or maybe buy a ticket. Some of them are free, but just paying attention to that.
So are all of the events inside of this month screenings of different kinds?
Some of them are screenings. Some of them are just conversations. Some of them are both. But it's just really looking at Black women in film and in this world of cinematography.
The next event is actually a festival that I believe is a yearly kind of thing from Latino Arts.
Yeah, so this would be the 7th annual festival, I believe. And it's the Latino Arts String Program Guitar Festival. Latino Arts began this program, the strings program, in 2002. And it was a way to engage Latinx students with music so they get a chance to, you know, play a musical instrument, learn how to read music, and have that, like, team bonding if they happen to be in a band. And so I know a couple weeks ago during Milwaukee Museum Week, the program was able to play at the Pabst Mansion, and so now they're having their concert. So it's going to be a competition for the youth to, you know, show off their skill and maybe win some prizes. And there's going to be a workshop for people who are interested in learning some classical guitar and more about it. And a lot more. There's going to be performances by Alina Chekin and Rafael Padron. They're both really well known in the guitar world. They've performed at international festivals. So I think that's going to be really exciting for people to see local talent and then some international talent too. This one, actually, just to note, is not free. Tickets cost $10 for adults and $8 for students.
Alrighty, so of course, February is also when we have Valentine's Day, and I think this next event really pays homage to that.
Yes, this next event is the Father-Daughter Dance, and it's hosted by Milwaukee Recreation and the Milwaukee Fatherhood Initiative, and the Social Development Commission also helps out. It's their annual Daddy-Daughter Dance, and it's just a great opportunity for fathers to bond with their daughters. And it's the day after Valentine's Day. So, you know, if you want to go on that date, go ahead. And then the next day you can spend with your kids. And then this one has two options. You can do the dinner and dance, so you will pay a little bit more. And then you also have the option to do just the dance only. This one, I was told the other day that tickets kind of sell out quickly. So if people are interested, to definitely look at it.
So where is it going to be?
It's going to be at the North Division Community Center from 5 to 8 p.m. And all ages are welcome to attend.
So our last event, to me, sounds a little romantic, but also incredibly cold.
That was my thought, too. When I first saw it, the candlelight hike with the Urban Ecology Center. But I was like, you know, it is Wisconsin. People know to bundle up. But yeah, so the Urban Ecology Center is hosting an urban candlelight hike. The hike is going to take place along the Hank Aaron State Trail in Three Bridges Park from 5:30 to 8:30. And it's only 2 miles long. So I say only, but you know, I think once you're walking and you see the beauty of it, it won't be that bad. And there's going to be the option of campfires and marshmallow roasting and a lot of fun. So the hike itself is free. And then if you want to participate in some of the other events, such as, you know, if you want to have a cup of hot chocolate or marshmallow to roast around the campfire, you will have to purchase the Fun Pass. And then that Fun Pass will get you access to a lot more of the other activities. But I think this is a great opportunity to kind of meet with other community members and maybe engage with people that you normally wouldn't. Hiking can be kind of solitary, so it's a good opportunity to go out there and meet people.
And get some level of exercise during the winter.
Yeah, exactly. And I, you know, it gets dark so quickly. I don't think people like going outside, but, you know, it's a good opportunity to go out and there's going to be candles. It's going to be, I think, quite the sight.
All right. Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Anna Martinez-Ortiz is a community engagement reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find links to all of the events they talked about at WUWM.com. Well, one of the things you can do in Milwaukee tonight is hear our next guests in concert. We'll visit the Prometheus Trio as they prepare music of Beethoven, Brahms, and Moravec for this evening's performance. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The piano trio is one of classical chamber music's most common groupings of musicians. As the name indicates, the piano is the constant. The other two instruments can include the French horn and the clarinet, but the two most common are the violin and the cello. From Haydn and Mozart to contemporary composers, the repertoire for the piano trio is large and diverse. Milwaukee's Prometheus Trio is playing three pieces that span the timeline from early Beethoven to Brahms to the contemporary composer Paul Moravec. The trio is pianist Stephanie Jacob, violinist Margot Schwartz, and cellist Scott Tisdell. Here they are with part of the first movement of Beethoven's Opus 1 in C minor. Margot, Stephanie, and Scott, it is such a pleasure to finally sit down with you as the Prometheus Trio and hear some music and have a little conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming down to the conservatory. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. And we just heard some Beethoven. And I was saying to someone before I came down here, I didn't know what you was on the concert. I purposely didn't look. And I said, oh, I hope there's some Beethoven and I hope there's some Brahms. And there is both of those things. Tell me a little bit about this Beethoven piece, because it's very early in his career, right?
It is early. It says in my music, 1793 to 94 was when it was composed. So he was 23, 24, and a young lion, big piano part that he wrote for himself. He was still studying with Haydn, at least nominally. That was something he did when he left Bonn and moved to Vienna. And
I can hear it in the way it's composed. It sounds, there's a little bit of Haydn there.
Yes, yeah. But Haydn actually, this is the third of a set of three, and apparently it was the one that Beethoven liked best. It's the only one in a minor key. And Haydn thought it was just way too shocking for then contemporary audiences. So you almost have to listen to it with old ears, really old ears, and be shocked by it.
And this is before Beethoven really kind of launched into what would become the romantic stuff that he became, right? I mean,
yeah,
he was still very much in the classical.
Yeah, but it's there. It's there.
It still sounds like Beethoven.
Oh, totally.
It really, I mean, you could say there are certain Haydn-esque elements to it, but sort of the shocking part, I think, is something that we have tried to
work on really hard.
Emphasize. Sorry. And it's Opus 1, but he wrote a lot of music before then. He wanted his Opus 1 to be something important, and that's why he was very annoyed with Haydn for not liking what he thought was his best one, and even thought Haydn might be a little jealous of his work.
And then we move from Beethoven to the other big B, one of the other big Bs, which is Brahms. And this piece is one of my favorites in the entire repertoire. Mm-hmm. There's just that opening, however many measures, it just, you know, I feel like my whole body just kind of aligns somewhere,
yeah.
You know, that I didn't even know that I was out of alignment until I heard those chords and mm-hmm. that music. And that must be so much fun to play.
It's so satisfying. It's this I've only been playing since I was in college, but it's just every Brahms trio that I'm playing, there are the three big ones, the three for this arrangement, and then there's the horn trio and the clarinet trio. Whichever piece I'm playing by Brahms is my favorite at the time. So right now this is my favorite, but it isn't really to diss the other ones.
And one of the things I love the way he, and we'll hear it in just a minute,
yeah.
But you know, you start and then the cello comes in with that deep, rich, and then the violin
yeah.
comes in and adds, and the layering
yes.
of this is so delicious.
Yeah, it's so gorgeous that, I don't know, me personally, I have to kind of say, okay, we have, 30 or 50 bars before he ever actually writes a forte, and it's very easy to kind of get overcooked too soon, and that kind of, in a way, spoils it. So I try to start it asking rather soft, even though it's extremely rich sounding.
Do you find the same, Margot, that it's just, you
yeah.
almost get lost in it? It's so beautiful.
Yeah, it has a real warmth mm-hmm. about it. Obviously not surprising for Brahms, like you said. But the key, I think, is, again, kind of surprising, because you think of a key with five sharps. You would think it would be sort of uncomfortable or sort of like you ate something too sour or something, but then it's so warm, and I wonder what made him pick that key. There's other pieces of his that are also warm, but they're in sort of more reasonable keys. So this seems kind of like an aberration, and I just wonder what kind of possessed him.
Well, you kind of feel like maybe he meant B flat, which would be even warmer.
Yeah.
Right.
But then it would be overcooked.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's just maybe, something, there's something very bright about it while also having that warmth, which is an interesting combination.
You mentioned before you started it that it was written in 1854, but he reworked it in the 1890s. What did he change?
Oh, most especially the length. Like the original version of the first movement that we played a bit of is over 400 measures, and this is, I think it's in the low 300s, I think.
So he cut.
Oh, he cut a lot. He cut a lot.
He improved it immensely in the revision.
The version we're playing, it sounds wonderfully leisurely. You don't know, unless you do know, that it's streamlined, but it is considerably streamlined from the original.
All right. Well, let's hear the piece, the part of it that you're going to play, and go ahead and reintroduce it, if you would.
This is the first movement of Brahms's wonderful B major trio, written originally in 1854 and revised in 1891.
Thank you. a little bit of Brahms to put in the middle of our interview. Before we get to the last piece, I want to talk a little bit about chamber music in general, because it is one of my favorite, no matter the type of music, whether it's classical or jazz or rock and roll, whatever. I like a small ensemble because mm-hmm. I want to hear all the parts. I like hearing the interplay. I mean, I love symphonies too, but there's something about this. And so I know, Scott, you're with the Milwaukee Symphony. Margot, do you play at the Symphony also?
Yeah.
So what does this do for you that playing for the Symphony does not?
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing is that we are our own bosses. We get to decide, you know, how we want to play it, the tempo, you know, the inflection, the phrasing. And that's really empowering to be in control of what you're doing, whereas we follow the conductor in an orchestra, and that, you know, depending on the conductor, that can be wonderful too, but it's really nice to be in charge. But the other thing is, you know, we're string players. We have many people playing the same part as us, and we have a lot more responsibility when we just have one on a part.
Well, for me, it's about the repertoire. It's just so incredible. I mean, yes, piano trio, but also string quartet. There's so much music out there that is, you know, you just wouldn't want to miss the chance to play it. And orchestra music is also really satisfying to play, most of it. I would say that for me, it's about the chance to just also deepen your understanding of each composer. The symphonic repertoire has certain qualities that are just not possible with chamber music, and vice versa. So it's a really nice way to understand the language of a composer or of a style of music or something like that.
And so you could make the case, I know that Brahms and Beethoven both wrote fantastic orchestra music, but you could make the case that in both cases, their greatest music is their chamber music. I mean, I think that's a pretty strong case. And I mean, you talk about the Beethoven string quartets or any of Brahms' chamber music that he didn't destroy is an absolute masterpiece.
How long has Prometheus been in some iteration now? Okay. It's been long before I got here.
This is our 20th season. And this is, what season is it of yours?
I think five.
Yeah. So this is the first time we've played it with Margot. So each time that we've played it with somebody else. And they've all been wonderful, just as each Brahms piece that I'm playing is my favorite. You know, each violinist is my favorite at the time. Yeah. And it's, I mean, each time I get to play this piece, it's just, it's the best. It's just the Brahms in particular. But I would just say, for me playing chamber music, because I don't play an orchestra except extra very occasionally, for me, it's the comparison of playing solo piano and playing chamber music or playing a gig. Playing a gig is fine, and it's fun always. And I do a lot of collaborating with, especially with student violinists and cellists, and it's really fun for me. But ever since I discovered chamber music, which was at music camp when I was 12 years old, like, that's been my thing. And I got to play my first Beethoven piano trio when I was 13, and I was like, oh, this is what I should be doing. This is my thing.
It's like you feel at home.
Yeah, this is totally at home. And we've been so grateful all these years to the conservatory for, you know, giving us a home. And they were the ones who first sponsored us when we started. Like, this is as a resident ensemble. And that's just been a wonderful partnership.
And so looking forward, there's no end in sight.
Hopefully not.
Yeah. Lots more repertoire.
Yes. And because we don't want to repeat anything too often, but at the same time, why wouldn't we play the greatest pieces? But then there are the less explored parts of the repertoire or newer pieces. We do quite a few relatively recently composed pieces.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the things that I know is a hallmark for you is to bring in at least one, what most of us would consider new.
Yeah.
Even if it's been in the last 10 or 20 years, it's not part of the 19th century and early 20th century repertoire. It's, you know, it's later. And so when you come into something like what we're going to hear, which was written, what, about 12 years ago, something like that?
Yeah, about that.
So very recent. Uh-huh.
And he's still alive.
And he's still, so living composer. Mm-hmm. And when you start thinking about that repertoire, do you approach it any differently, or is it exactly the same way you'd approach the Brahms or approach the Beethoven?
Well, the biggest difference is we're starting from scratch. We're kind of fans of Paul Moravec. Stephanie and I, we've played, this is our third piece of his?
Third and fourth, yeah.
Third and fourth pieces. So we kind of know what to expect with his music, but it's always fun to kind of build a piece up from the ground.
Yeah, because you're not building on 150 years of tradition of other people playing it. Yeah.
And what's more, we're not building on our own tradition as we are with the Brahms of, oh yeah, this is what we do. And of course, we're doing it with Margot, so we're going to discuss what it is we do and we're going to change things. But there's this comfort level that with a new piece, then that's a different kind of comfort level because we're exploring it together.
And yeah. The little bit I heard, and we're going to hear some in just a moment, he's actually very melodic.
Oh, very melodic, yeah. Very tonal, gorgeous harmonies, and I think that's what draws us most to him.
Well, I want to thank you, all three of you, for playing for us, for talking with me. After 14 years, it's about time I got here. We've been trying to do this for the last 10 years,
right,
I think, and
right.
So we finally got it done. I'm looking forward to hearing the Moravec, but before I do, I just want to say thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for everything.
The Prometheus Trio performing the music of Paul Moravec. Jason Reavy recorded the music and the conversation at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. That's where the trio will perform this evening. There is more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.